You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 2016 Western Christadelphian Bible School at Manuka. This is the fourth class in a series given by Brother Cameron Beeler on the subject, Our Kingdom Lives. This class is titled, My Sabbath.
Good morning, brothers and sisters. Well, that was pretty good. I think everyone's had their coffee this morning. I think we have a couple of pages still being handed out. Thank you, sir. Appreciate that. Had several great don't you put that on my head. I saw that thought go through your mind. Had several great conversations yesterday. I've got several new notes for the future class, so I appreciate that. I always enjoy feedback. I don't always agree with all of it, but that's okay. In time, perhaps I too will come to understand some of the deep thinking that's going on around here. I did want to share one thing and then ask a couple of things. One thing that was proposed is maybe the reason, I mean, because we could have had, you know, 8.some odd percent with 12 going to 1, and maybe it was practical that 10's easier to figure out than 8.33% or whatever it would have been. Or maybe the Levitical priesthood ended up getting a tithe because it was a good round number that also matched the number that was given to Melchizedek and is intended to draw our attention back to the tithe given to Melchizedek. Which would have an interesting implication, right? Because ultimately, it's Melchizedek that's the priesthood in picture, right? That's the priesthood we're intended to finish our focus on, not the Levitical. Levitical is just an entry priesthood. It has its purposes. Don't think I'm, you know, not or understating that. It has very specific and very real purpose. But for us, we don't end up in the Levitical priesthood, right? We end up in the Melchizedekan priesthood. So that was kind of an interesting place to end up from a gentleman, a little Zulu man who asked, what am I supposed to do with this whole tithing thing? It has a practical application because after I finished studying that, instead of telling him, you shouldn't have to tithe because the Levitical order is not in place, there's actually a whole different message, isn't there? What kind of message did you get out of it? And I hope I delivered it well enough that you actually got a message out of it. What's the implication of the shift from a Levitical order with tithing of 10% of everything you have to shifting to a Melchizedekan order? Beautiful. Give of our time as well as our money. Eric. You give of our gifts. Absolutely. Absolutely. No one is without a gift. And in our community, everyone gives just whatever it is that God has enriched them with to give. Right? I am going to go this way for a second, and it's not part of our Sabbath class, and I'm very excited to have a Sabbath conversation because it really fits in. The thing I see with the institution of church that has been around for thousands of years is that the institution of church, in this conversation, the institution of church elevates somebody whose qualification is first, usually, being a great speaker, and second, hopefully, having biblical depth. But you don't see a lot of, you know, preachers of big institutionalized churches who are great Bible students who can't speak. The order of value is can deliver a message beautifully because that's what people want to hear. And it's really, really good if you end up having biblical or some sort of agreement with an arranged, you know, statements of faith or whatever, so they follow the denomination's teachings and whatnot. But you won't find a massive church that has somebody who's a wonderful Bible student that can't deliver. Because the first, the requisite, right, the requirement is first delivered. The second thing that happens in that kind of institution is it's very, very, very easy for the people of the institution to accept that the work has been done and they're asked to contribute and their contribution is finance, generally. There are exceptions. But if a church has 5,000 people in it, you don't have 5,000 people with their distinct gifts all doing their thing under the management of the one and then the board and, right? Generally what happens is everybody donates and a substantial majority of the church then go home having done their fair share. And they've given 10%. Right? And kind of where I go, and I know this is generalization, and there are examples, there are actually exceptions to every example, but as a generalization, what that does is it allows the population or the congregation to abdicate responsibility to do more than just contribute. They come, they hear, they contribute, they go home, and we know about Sunday belief systems. Right? But what God has actually put in place is this non-institutionalized approach where we all have to identify who we are and, you know, who we are and where we are and what we've been given so that we then find a way to contribute what's given to us and overflow that to others. There are no exceptions. No one goes home after Sunday meeting and gets to abdicate responsibility to the teachers and whatnot while they go home and live their lives. Because God doesn't want 10%. What's he want? All right, Now you've got funny math going on there. Right? But yeah, I love the 110% conversation because what that is it redefines what 100 really looks like because people give, they're willing to give 100%, but it looks a whole lot more like 10%. Right? So anyway, we're that's where it comes from, right? So I'm going to ask it one more time. God doesn't want 10%. He wants 100%. We belong to him. There's a whole line of conversation going on. It's in Romans as one example, but it's not the only place. He doesn't want part of you. And I used to say this when I would share, you know, what I was seeing in this as I was studying it and whatnot. I'd say, you know, if you can't manage to give yourself to God, I guess 10% is okay. But you're applying yourself to a whole different institution. It's not the one that Jesus established, right? He doesn't want your 10%. He can make money all day long. All he needs is more fish, right? So anyway, so you've got the point. So I'm going to ask you the question. What are we to give? 100% out of whatever it is that God has given us to give, okay? And it's different for every person. I do like the conversation there is that ecclesia that was actually giving money that was going to Jerusalem and Paul has a conversation, I believe it's 2 Corinthians 10, and he's actually saying to them, he goes from the money conversation and says, I just want to reinforce with you that it's beautiful that you have a gift to give. You've made a vow to give it. Whatever it is you vowed, that you do and you should do it. Well, you know, you should do it with joy. And I have seen, and I've even done where I knew I was kind of under obligation to give. And I guess it's a process getting to the point where what you love and what you have and you give joyfully. But I know that the period of time where I gave because I knew it was an obligation, that there was something I should do, but I was doing it even kind of in duress. Other than maybe it's progressive, there's no benefit in that. God doesn't want you to do it because you have to. He wants you to do it because you connect to the fact that He has given you so much. And it means so much to you and you're so grateful to Him that out of the overflow you're giving to others because you see yourself a steward of what He's giving you and giving to others. And that's a joyful action. It's because we want to. Because we know the benefit of it and we care for the people that we're around. Sabbath. Did you hear the gears? These just clunk, clunk. I'm going to ask you a question. Where do we see Sabbath conversation in the Bible? That's right. Her creation and her Genesis. Let's turn to Genesis 2. It's going to be the first three verses of Genesis 2. Who would like to read Genesis 2, verse 1, 2, and 3 for me? Could be up in the top. I haven't had any up top readers. Who wants to belt it out from up there? Anyone? Bueller? Anyone? All right, Norm. It's Genesis 2, verses 1 through 3.
Thus the heavens and the earth were completed in all their vast array. By the seventh day God had finished the work he had been doing, so on the seventh day he rested from all his work. And God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it he rested from all the work of creating that he had done.
Very good. Thank you very much. So the institution of the Sabbath, or the origination of the Sabbath, begins in the creation. And distinctly, what are the components of the Sabbath? As mentioned, Genesis 2, just, yes, sir.
Resting,
right? It's when God rests from all his work, right? There's another kind of interesting thing about it, which isn't obvious. And I talked to my Genesis class about this, and I love it. But every day begins in, I mean, this is a general Genesis question, and I haven't really brought this up. But every day starts with what? At darkness, right? I mean, the first day is created dark, and then God creates a light. And he says, and there it was, evening, morning, first day. Six times you get evening and morning. So on the sixth day, which begins in darkness, it ends in light, and then the seventh day begins. And you know what it doesn't say in Genesis 2? It doesn't say, and there was evening and there was morning the seventh day. It just stays quiet. So the last piece of information you have about the day-night or night-day order is in the sixth day, which ends in light, which kind of leaves the seventh day in light. It's interesting. There's no conversation about night in the seventh day. So it kind of implies that the seventh day is a day of light. So I love those two things. So right or wrong, here's a true and false question, that the establishment of the Sabbath is a Mosaic establishment. True or false? Say that again. True or false? There's always one, isn't there? There's always one. Right, right, right. That's the 110% conversation coming back at us, isn't it? Duncan. So what I get out of the conversation is that it's a creation construct. It's a creation construct. And what's really interesting is it's not just on the first, you know, the proverbial first page. Where else would we find the construct of the Sabbath coming alive? In the new creation and in the kingdom. In Hebrews. Okay, where in Hebrews is it? Yeah, it's 3 and 4, right? So we're going to look at something. But I'm going to look, before we go to Hebrews, the verses I'm going to pull up are verses 1 through 11 in Hebrews, so that's kind of a sneak peek. We're going to go to Exodus chapter 20. Now, I do this because there is emphasis made about the Sabbath in the law of Moses and in the commandments. But I wanted to start off by showing that it is not a Mosaic construct. It's reinforced in the Mosaic, but it's not a Mosaic construct. And I think that's incredibly important. The exact same as circumcision. That's Abrahamic, right? And although it's reinforced in the Mosaic, it doesn't get its emphasis or its authority from the Mosaic. The Mosaic is reinforcing what's established by God with Abraham. So let's have somebody read the Exodus 20, verse 9 and verse 10. Who would like to read that? Yes, ma'am.
6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, neither you nor your son or daughter, nor your manservant or maidservant, nor your animals, nor the alien within your gates.
Okay, good enough. So I want to make sure we catch the emphasis, because I have several contexts that I believe always should be considered. The first context that should always be considered is everything that I find in the Scripture is pointing in some way to God's master plan. And God's master plan is fully realized when every one of us exhibit God's character in the kingdom. We're all his children, and we all exercise authority and power as the family of God. And there is no more sin, no more, you know, hardship, trials, dying, death. All that's gone away. It's the new order of things, and that is the culmination of God's master plan. So everything we find here is going to connect to that in some way. The second context is, of course, you can't pull one verse out. And it's important when you go look at verse 10, because verse 10 says you shall do no work. And that's pretty, you know, if you go to Newton and talk about work, you're saying, you know, anytime you get movement, you're going to end up with force, and you're going to, and that's the definition kind of in there of work, is activity creates work, right? And so you could look at this and say, well, he says you can't do any work. And so this is what the Pharisees did, is they said, well, that means you shouldn't walk more than so many steps, and you shouldn't, right? And we know the conversations that happened with Jesus and the Pharisees. But verse 9 kind of gives you a clue to something. And verse 9 says, you know what? You should work 6 days. You should plow the fields. You should take care of your cattle. You should do these things. And that work is talking about provision. It's self-provisioning. So when we get the work conversation in verse 10, it's not saying that you shouldn't be in motion or you shouldn't be doing things. It's saying you shouldn't be plowing your field. Right? Because the seventh day is about God, not about serving yourself. And therein lies the key of this commandment, that the seventh day is a day dedicated to God in service, because it's connected to something. It's not standing on its own. It's connected both backward and forward. Does that make sense? The Sabbath day in the Mosaic command, he's reminding us that we need to connect backward to the creation and forward to the culmination of God's master plan for the earth, right? The Sabbath day. So let's look at Hebrews 4, 1 through 11. And you know I'm going to ask for volunteer. Now really seriously, is there somebody up there that would be happy to belt out your, I think we should be able to hear you really well, reading Hebrews 4, 1 through 11.
Therefore, since the promise of entering his rest still stands, let us be careful that none of you be found to have fallen short of it. For we also have had the gospel preached to us, just as they did. But the message they heard was of no value to them, because those who heard it did not combine it with faith. Now we, who have believed, entered that rest, just as God had said. So I declared on oath in my anger, they shall never enter my rest. And yet his work has been finished since the creation of the world. For somewhere he has spoken about the seventh day in these words, and on the seventh day God rested from all his work. And again in the passage above, he says, they shall never enter my rest. It still remains that some will enter that rest, and those who formerly had the gospel preached to them did not go in because of their disobedience. Therefore, God again set a certain day, calling it today, when a long time later he spoke through David, as was said before, today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts. For if Joshua had given them rest, God would not have spoken later about another day. There remains then a Sabbath rest for the people of God. For anyone who enters God's rest also rests from his own work, just as God did from his. Let us, therefore, make every effort to enter that rest, so that no one will fall by following their example of disobedience.
Thank you very much, Nate. So you see, I didn't actually make part of that up. What did he bring up in that verse? About work, rest from your works, right? Because it's, what else, what's peculiar? Because Hebrews 4 brings up a really interesting, strange thing for me.
We have entered
that
rest.
Exactly, right? And we're looking forward to enter that rest. What else?
That's
an interesting implication. And I would love to run with that, so. There's another point. We're going to actually talk about something that's very much in that path. But there's something else that he says that I find very peculiar. Yes, sir. His works were finished from the foundation of the world. That, I like Isaiah 55. To me, verse 11 says exactly the same thing, right? His word goes out from him. It does not return to him void. Instead, it continues until it accomplishes everything that God has set forth. And I think this is a framework. Both a framework and a point of view conversation from God. I think it's a great point that we don't see it finished, but that's because we have a right now vision. God doesn't have a right now vision. He has an all now vision. There's something else. What else is in there? Yes, it is, because there's several things. But let me give the one that really kind of tripped me when I saw it. You know, I read Genesis 2:1-3, and God rested from his work. And this seems to allude to me that while the statement in Genesis is a past tense conversation, he's making it a future tense conversation. He's saying it's coming. He's saying that Sabbath is yet to come. It's the kingdom age, right? It's the kingdom age. Let us make every effort to enter into that rest. Yes, ma'am. Absolutely. Absolutely. It's an aspirational conversation, right? And we're in day six. But it's a funny thing. It's almost like we're in day six trying to live in day seven so that when day seven gets here, right? And that's not really in my script. But I actually think, just to be really clear, that God says you can be six or you can be seven. Seven is still coming, but you have to choose today if you're six or if you're seven. Are you going to live as a man for manly interests, or are you going to live as a man for kingdom interests? Because those, how do you say this? I've got a child, and I've got two or three children in my household, and I've got to take care of my household, right? And if my kids, every time I say, hey, it's time to mow the yard, and they're like, hey, where did my kids go? Did they know it was chore time? How did this happen? But if my kids are like, hey, Dad, we know it's time to mow the yard. We know we need, you know, the dishes need to be cleaned. And you know, why are you doing it? It's not your chores. And they're saying, yeah, but it's our house. And one day I'm going to be writing my will saying, well, you know what? They loved the household and it's going to become theirs. Or one day I could say, they have no interest in this house. They've never had an interest in this house. Every time something needed to be done to be taken care of this house, they ran to their friend's house. It's like they want their friend's house, not my house. I think I'm going to sell it and give it to charity. Someone is going to love it somewhere. And I actually take that simple and quite maybe common as opposed to holy metaphor to say that we actually are living in God's house. So just so it's known, I absolutely agree with what you just said. And that's where the class is going, because we're going to talk today about Sabbath. And we're going to talk today about the exhortation in life that Jesus gives. And let me make real clear, Jesus did more than we know. But what he did and what was written about what he did is instructive for us. It's very intentional. It's not just the words that came out of his mouth. It's every step he took that's written is instructive for us. And it's very important, right? This isn't where we decide what we like and don't like. This is where we watch what Jesus did and decide, how can I change to follow that? And I will add one caveat to the comment that was made. We choose to live in the kingdom. And if you said yes to Jesus and that's your life commitment, then the kingdom life is what you're living. And if you're not, right, that's trouble. But if you said you committed to the kingdom and that's what you love, then that's why we're here. And if you're struggling with that, that's why the person next to you on your left or your right or in front or behind you is here, because part of what we're given is to encourage, strengthen, and help and lift up, right? So that we might all walk there together. You don't have to live in the kingdom, but that has its own ramifications, and they're not pretty. Let's turn to Matthew 12. We're going to read the first seven verses. This is one of, I believe, three different accounts, all of which say very much the same thing. So I want somebody who is prepared to read verse 1 through 7, Matthew 12, verses 1 through 7. Yes, Bob.
At that time, Jesus went through the grain fields on the Sabbath. His disciples were hungry and began to pick some heads of grain to eat them. When the Pharisees saw this, they said to him, "Look, your disciples are doing what is unlawful on the Sabbath." He answered, "Haven't you read what David did when he and his companions were hungry? He entered the house of God, and he and his companions ate the consecrated bread, which was not lawful for them to do, but only for the priests. Or haven't you read in the law that on the Sabbath the priests in the temple desecrated the day and yet are innocent? I tell you that one greater than the temple is here. If you had known what these words mean, I desire mercy, not sacrifice, you would not have condemned the innocent.
Interesting. Thanks. Now, I love digging into this kind of stuff. And we don't have as much time as I would like to dig into this one, right? But I'm going to share with you that as experts in the law, one of the things you know that the Pharisees would do is they would debate Scripture. And they would talk through Scripture and they would try to understand. And there would be hard topics, right? And David is referenced in two places in lineage. One of them's the seventh born. One of them's the eighth son, right? And there's kind of an interesting implication if you like to follow numbers and patterns and kind of their suggestions and symbolic suggestions. And I love the image of David because he's a Christ type or messianic type. He points forward to Jesus quite directly. And so if you talk about David being, you know, a seventh or David being an eighth, and we know that Christ is going to be the king of the seventh day that leads us into the eighth day, you get this interesting picture, which has nothing to do with what I'm talking about. So, moving on, David's the interesting thing, however, about David is David did something when he was anointed, after the time he was anointed to be king, that was very, very unusual. He went into the holy with the high priest and took the showbread. And he was going to use it for himself, and he was going to use it for those men who were with him. Does anybody remember the story of the because he's actually in the presence of the high priest at this time. And what is the countenance of the high priest in the presence of David? Does anybody remember? He trembled. And when I first read that, I thought, well, that's very peculiar, but maybe it's because David is anointed to be king. And then the next passage, however, is the high priest in the presence of Saul, who isn't anointed to be king. He's actually the king. And you know what he does in the presence of the king? Well, he doesn't tremble. With his life on the line, he's not afraid of the king. And the king accuses him of conspiring with his enemies. He's like, David's your man. He's not one of your enemies. He's your man. And the king does what any good king would do, and he kills him and he kills his family, except a few that escape. So he's happy to confront the king. But when he's in the presence of David, he trembles. And then he does what any good high priest does. He gives him the showbread and he gives him, you know, Goliath's sword. David has a couple of other things. But you know, as a Pharisee, I'm just going to make one other point. Who would the high priest be afraid of? Who would he be, you know, trembling in the presence of? Well, God, or somebody that would be above him. Who's above the high priest of the Levitical order in Israel? Not the king. It's worth thinking about. It's worth thinking about enough that you know the Pharisees had thought about it, had debated it, had, you know, had possible scenarios where that might have been a real situation. We're not told exactly what's going on with David, though we know that David does a few things. He offers bread and wine. He carries the Ark of the Covenant into Jerusalem. He does some things that are very priestly, but he's not Levitical. And he's not a firstborn. And the high priest of the Levitical order trembles in his presence. Just saying. So Jesus, after the Pharisees come to him and accuse him, he puts two things together. Really interesting. Have you thought about David with his men that were traveling with him that got the bread that was in the holies and gave it to his men? And you know that they knew that the high priest trembled in his presence. Have you not also read that a priest, right, that a priest operates on the Sabbath and is not guilty? He's held innocent. Why is that? Because he's doing God's work. He's not doing his work. His work is God's work, and God's work is done on the Sabbath. You can't hold a man guilty for doing God's work on God's day. You can hold a man guilty for doing his work on God's day. Right? And you know what's interesting? Is in verse 8, there are no Pharisees. They go, pfft. Right? Let me ask you a question, just worth thinking through. Do you think a Pharisee would take issue with the high priest in his order in his work and go and tell the high priest what he thinks the high priest ought to do? Do you think the Pharisee would expect that he has the authority to correct the high priest? Just anybody. Right? We should be seeing a lot of this right now, right? The highest order in the Levitical, which is over all of Israel, is the high priest. You don't go tell the high priest what his job is, because he's the guy that's representing God to you, not the other way around. But here is a suggestion. Jesus is laying a suggestion at their feet. He doesn't tell them what it implies. They understand what it implies. That's why verse 8 doesn't have any Pharisees talking to Jesus about his apostles taking grain off the plants on the Sabbath. They disappear. Because it's a powerful suggestion. And it's about the Sabbath. And I especially, again, emphasize verse 5. The priests, right? The priests work on the Sabbath because they're doing God's will and they are not guilty. Turn with me to another example, John 7, 23. It's the Gospel of John, chapter 7, verse 23. Yes, sir, Eric, thank you.
Now, if a child can be circumcised on the Sabbath, so that the law of Moses may not be broken, why are you angry with me for healing the whole man on the Sabbath?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting, right? Because the cutting away of the flesh, the circumcision, right? The symbology of that. But what does circumcision point forward to? The removal of flesh, which is actually about something else. What is the removal, the physical removal of flesh, actually about? Pardon? Ultimately, the eighth day, right? Where there is no sin remaining in the world. I mean, when we think of flesh, we ought to think of sin, because there's sin in the flesh, right? And the influence of sin in the flesh. So the idea of circumcision is the sign of the covenant in this day in particular, is the sign of God's covenant with the people that he's claiming to become his own. Right? And we know that what he's going to do with those who are his own is going to eventually move sin, which we know is the last enemy to be destroyed, which is the final step to realizing God's master plan on the earth. This is what Jesus is telling them. They already know most of this. And he's saying, but what I've done, okay, first of all, they've got to back up one. John does a really good job of showing that there's an assumption that's held by the leaders in the day that those people who are lame and sick, that they are all lame and sick and blind and whatever because of one thing. What is that? Sin. So their presumption is the people who are healthy therefore must have no, Yeah, that doesn't work at all. But this is exactly where the leaders are, because they're looking, you know, here's a healthy, you can't even be a Pharisee, by the way, if you're not healthy and whatnot. Here's a healthy Pharisee and he knows he's without sin, looking at the poor person over here who has a priestly kind of role he should actually be helping. But the reason he's sick is because he has, I don't want to be unclean. I mean, if I come in contact with this poor, helpless sinner, you know, maybe some of it will rub off on me. And you see how the dynamic of the Pharisees was with the people, right? And what Jesus is saying is, gosh, I just healed him. What does that mean? I removed his, he's using their convention on them, isn't he? He's saying, you think the reason he was sick was because he was sinful. I just removed his sickness. What does that make him? What's that about? Isn't that about the Sabbath? So that's what he's connecting. He's connecting those dots. You didn't even want to touch him because he was in unclean. I've removed his uncleanness. You're doing the sign of circumcision, which is talking about the removal of sin. I've just purified him, which is talking about the removal of sin, and you're going to condemn me for it. So what is your hope of the Sabbath? The implicit conversation that's under the overt activity is what Jesus is going for, and they get it, but they still don't like what he's doing. Let's turn to John 9. I love this verse. This could be I actually have a whole exhort on just this. Don't worry, I'm not going to do that to you. But I want someone who's going to be happy to read for me 9:1-14. Yes, sir. Thank you.
As he went along, he saw a man blind from birth. His disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" "Neither this man nor his parents sinned," said Jesus, "but this happens so that the work of God might be displayed in his life. As long as it is day, we must do the work of him who sent me. Night is coming when no one can work. While I am in the world, I am the light of the world." Having said this, he spit on the ground, made some mud with the saliva, and put it on the man's eyes. "Go," he told him, "wash in the pool of Siloam," which means sent. So the man went and washed, and he came home seeing. His neighbors and those who had formerly seen him begging asked, "Isn't this the same man who used to sit and beg?" Some claimed that he was. Others said, "No, he only looks like him." But he himself insisted, "I am the man." "How then were your eyes open?" they demanded. He replied, "The man they called Jesus made some mud and put it on my eyes. He told me to go to Siloam and wash. So I went and washed, and then I could see." "Where is this man?" they asked. "I don't know," he said. And they brought to the Pharisees the man who had been blind. Now the day on which Jesus made the mud and opened the man's eyes was a Sabbath.
It was a Sabbath when Jesus made the clay. I love this, and I am going to touch on two things. And then I'm kind of going to bring it all together for you. If you're wondering why I'm wandering around this stuff, there's a bringing it together stage here. But I want to actually talk about this because I love this so much. And there's a conversation, I believe it's in Jeremiah or Ezekiel, and there's a conversation where in the past, you know, God actually says to the prophet, "In the past, you know, I would condemn a man for his actions, and it would roll down to his children, right? Or a child would sin, it would affect the whole family. But in the days coming, if a man sins, it affects him, not his family, right?" And there's this kind of this proclamation through a prophet. And so in here, at this point in time, you get the apostles who are familiar with this and with this premise. You know, of antiquity, it was like if a man sinned, it was his generations that would inherit the benefit of his sin. Right, but if a man was righteous, the generations would inherit the benefit of his righteousness, and that's one whole teaching. But there was a shift in that to you're responsible for you, and if you're responsible for you, but your children don't follow your path, they don't have to be held responsible for you, right? If you're responsible and your children sins, you're not going to be held to their sin, right? And that's kind of the conversation. So they have an interesting dilemma because this man was born blind, so now, with the teaching of the leaders that infirmity is the outcome of sin, what's the explanation for why he's blind? And that's the context of the conversation. Because it's really a tricky one, right? He's born blind, but if he's born blind and he's not responsible for his parents' sin, he's only responsible for his sin, but he was born blind, how does that work? And Jesus basically says, it's not really what you think it is. Actually, the things happen the way they happen because God puts them in place so that God's work can be seen through people at different times in various ways. So the reason this man is born blind is not because of sin at all. It's because God's work can be done through him. And it's going to take this special circumstance for Jesus to manifest a very special type of miracle. Right? And it's a way of natural judgment versus spiritual judgment. We end up in a place often enough where it's not necessarily an outcome of wrong living and unrighteous behavior. It might just be that God's work needs to be made known through us, and there are certain hardships that set the stage so that God can be seen. It's the objective God view as opposed to the subjective man view. And what the Pharisees of the day were trying to do is take their subjective view of reality and plastering it on the reality of different people and did it wrongly. Although that's not really a Sabbath conversation. The rest of the conversation, however, is Jesus bringing sight on the Sabbath. Now, it's interesting if you think about it that way. Think about it for yourself. Jesus brings sight on the Sabbath. Prior to the Sabbath, they're blind, but on the Sabbath, they see. this is a very specific, very real miracle, but it is not about this person. And the reason he brings sight on the Sabbath is so that God may be known. And that's what he says in here. It's not what you think it is. It isn't the outcome of sin. It's done this way so that God will be known. Jesus is going to bring sight on the Sabbath so that God can be seen. It's funny that that's actually what he says in here. But if you just look at the story, you can completely miss it. That's why I love this particular one. Right? So, now, we don't have to argue too much about whether or not Jesus came as a replacement for our requirement to live righteous versus being an example to what it means to living in God's family, right? Does everybody understand what I just said? Because there's a sneaky little conversation that happens if you believe that Jesus is a replacement for our obligation to live in the family, right? And it's taught in some circles, not all, but in some. And I don't hear it in Christadelphians at all, thankfully. Jesus didn't come to replace our responsibility to live and to live up to, aspire to righteous living in God's family. He came as an example, which means he's showing us the way. So when he talks about, I am the way, the expectation is that you follow, right? That's even the Nicodemus conversation. You're coming here to build an alliance. You draw me into an alliance with you, but I'm the one that's provided to lead people, to show them the way they are to go. How about you follow me, since God has provided me to show you the way, right? And it's about following. And following is the metaphor for patterning our life, living, changing, serving, helping, doing things that wouldn't be natural to us if we were just trying to feed ourselves. Because we're actually trying to feed the whole body. We're actually trying to collectively get there. So we look at the first Sabbath, and that Sabbath is at the end of the creation of the earth, and there is no sin upon the earth. I kind of talked about the dishes conversation, I think, 2 days ago, right? The earth is pure and pristine. It's gone from good to very good because this earth is now a manifestation of the glory of God and all of his creative, you know, activity and exercise. And so everywhere you'd look, you would see the hand of God at work and the beauty of the creation and no spoiling. It would just be an amazing place, inner in man, right? And so that first picture is actually the picture we aspire to, and that picture will return when the kingdom is completed, when the earth is perfected and completed in that Sabbath day that we're looking forward to. Right? And we know that Jesus is going to return to the earth. We have a lot of conversation about the return of Jesus to the earth and the establishment of the kingdom, and that all of those who are his will then work. And I don't know if you think a lot about that, right? But that won't be a workless activity. As a matter of fact, I kind of think about God has said, and we even saw in Hebrews 4, God has said that on the Sabbath day he rested, but he actually isn't talking about the day of, you know, after creation is finished and Adam is just built, you know, Adam is just constructed by hand and all this. He's actually, while there may be a physical reality there, what he's actually talking about is there's coming a day when God's not the one who's going to be doing the work. Or God's not the one who's going to be doing the work. As a matter of fact, where is Jesus right now? That's right, right? So let me just say it again. Jesus is sitting at the right hand of the throne of God right now. It's not like he's taking a vacation somewhere. In Hebrews 1, we're told that he's actually controlling the created. It talks about the heavenly powers and as if the whole universe is being managed by Jesus right now. And as I understand it, what's happened is Jesus has been elevated. He's had the name of God placed upon him, and that's Philippians 2:9. Yes, Eric? And we are here gathered in his name. Thank you. So we're going to hold this, and we're going to hold the kingdom thought right now, because this is where we're going right now, right, is that he's actually working. He's been given that. He hasn't taken it from God. He's been given it by God. It's his reward. We get that from 1 Corinthians 15, that he is in the position now where he's ruling, and he's ruling over everything. But a day is coming when he's returning to the earth and establishing the kingdom and sitting on the throne of David. But if you read Revelation 2 and Revelation 3, there are seven assertions for those who overcome, right? And in verse chapter 3, verse 12, and you can just write that down, Revelation chapter 3, verse 12, it says of Jesus, and actually Jesus says of us that if you are an overcomer, that I'm going to place the name of God on you. Well, Philippians 2, verse 9, God places his name on Jesus. And in Revelation 3, verse 12, Jesus places God's name on you and me. The whole name conversation is a whole nother class. But what it means is the name actually has meaning and we're to elevate to that name. And that's a physical change. That's a physical change. The second thing he says, and my new name will be upon you. So we have the Father's name, we have our brother's name, and then he says, and the name of the New Jerusalem will be upon you. And if you go to Galatians, I think you'll find a conversation that talks about the New Jerusalem and that she's our mother. So if you have the Father's name, the mother's name, and the brother's name, what are you in? The family, right? And we're also told that we'll be made like Jesus, right? But Jesus says there's a way. And I think that's a beautiful picture because then we know that it's not done, it's beginning. Now what is the life that we have on this earth? God, it's not that God can't be involved. God has actually said, look, if you're elevated to that state at that point in time, this is your reward. Because the thousand years of the Sabbath, it doesn't end at the end of the thousand years and then we die. What happens is that's the culmination of the earth back to its created state. Give me two more minutes there, Sean. Please, two more minutes. Anyway, it's the end of the... It actually progresses to the perfect state, right? Which is an expression of Genesis in chapter 2. The earth has been perfected and sin has been... You know, sin has entered into the world. Now sin has been removed from the world and we're back to the way God created it. And when it's back to the way God created it, what are we told? God returns. And he dwells in the presence of all of his family. And then we see the completion. Now I've done all of this, and here's what we need to know, is we're not waiting for the Sabbath. We're not waiting for the kingdom and the return of Jesus, because Jesus is active and operating right now. And what we've been told is that we're to work. Sorry, this is a little tricky. We're to do this work in our lives every day. Jesus didn't wait for the Sabbath to heal people. He did it every day, including the Sabbath. And what that does is it links all of his works, his compassion and his graciousness, his encouragement of the widows, his helping of the orphans, his teaching and instructing. He didn't wait for the Sabbath to do it. He did it on the Sabbath, which angered the Pharisees. But he did it to show that every single day was a Sabbath. Every single day was his Sabbath because he wasn't living in today. He was living in tomorrow. He wasn't living to provide for himself. And we do have to physically provide. I'm not saying we don't. But even when you physically provide, you have the opportunity to be an expression and a manifestation of that which is godly. So I have heard it said that we no longer have to follow the Sabbath. And I would propose a completely different paradigm. That's not actually true. What you do have to do is live the Sabbath every day in your life. You have to live the Sabbath every day in your life. If you can't manage to live in your Sabbath, in your kingdom, every day in your life, then the very least you can do is follow the Sabbath because it was established from the creation. But that 1/7 is the same as the 1/10 conversation. Does God want 1/7 of your week? Oh, this is really quiet. Does God want 1/7 of your week? What does he want? He wants every day. If you give God every day, you are following the Sabbath. It's not that we don't have a Sabbath, it's that every day is our Sabbath. You have to live for God. It's not a Sunday thing. It's not a first day versus a seventh day conversation. You're living for God. This is your Sabbath. You live it every single day. And if you can't manage that, I'm sorry to say, then you ought to give at least the 1/7. It's not a question of first or seventh. It's a question of what are you giving your life to? We're to give every day because every day we have is our Sabbath leading up to the Sabbath that we want to inherit.